Happy Friday, everybody. My name is Michael Cutler, and I welcome you to my program, The Michael Cutler Hour. I hope you've all had a good week. Looking forward to a terrific weekend, hopefully, for all of you out there. My name is, as I say, Michael Cutler, and I'm a retired senior special agent with what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service. To those of you familiar with the program, you know that I'm a retired former INS senior agent, and for the last, a decade or more, actually since 9/11, I have taken my show on the road in a manner of speaking to try to cover the issues that, quite frankly, the mainstream media are not covering. My concern is that we cannot win a successful war against the terrorists, against transnational gangs, against the Mexican drug cartels, unless we gain control over our borders and we enforce and administer the immigration law in a way befitting of this country, that has integrity, that honors those countless millions who over the last 225 years or so built this country. You know, we're often told America is a land of immigrants. Well, that's true. But let's be clear about it. The difference between an immigrant and an illegal alien is comparable to the difference between a house guest and a burglar. So my goal is to try to provide the perspectives that I've acquired, hard to believe, in 41 years since I entered on duty with the INS back in October 71, and to debunk a lot of the mythology, a lot of the rumors. I feel like one of the Mythbusters, except unlike the program, we don't get to use explosives on my program, but we do explode the myths. And today, in fact, a young lady by the name of Lauren Martell will be joining us. Lauren is an attorney from South Carolina, and I was with her and a whole bunch of Tea Partiers in Myrtle Beach just last weekend at the Tea Party Coalition Convention. But before we get to Lauren, and I know she's holding right now, which is good, so we have her with us, I want to put a couple of websites out there, because rather than talk about what I've done, you can read about it. This way we can get right into the meat of the program. And the three websites I would very much like for you to go to, first of all, michaelcutler.net. That's one word, M-I-C-H-A-E-L-C-U-T-L-E-R, michaelcutler.net. My second website is TalkBorder, one word, TalkBorder.com, TalkBorder. Again, that's one solid word. And finally, I'm a fellow with a wonderful organization based in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara, California, where the weather is almost always disgustingly wonderful. And I say disgustingly because I'm on the East Coast, and you know what New York weather can be like. But I have lots of friends in California. It's a pleasure to work with them, and I've been involved with Californians' population stabilization for quite some time. Their terrific website is capsweb.org, C-A-P-S-web.org. So please visit those three websites, and now I thank you for joining the program. And Lauren Martell, happy Friday to you. I thank you for joining us as well. How are you this evening?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm not in South Carolina this Friday as I was last Friday, back at home in New York and Brooklyn. But glad to chat with you. I know you're based in Hilton Head, which is just down the road a piece, as they might say in Texas, from Myrtle
Beach. Yeah, like 4 hours. It took a while, but it was worth it. That Myrtle Beach weekend was extraordinarily informative, wasn't it?
It absolutely was. What were your takeaways? By the way, why don't you just fill my audience in, just a thumbnail sketch about who you are and what mischief you're up to?
Well, you know, I'm just a small town, small island attorney who is interested in, some of the values that are espoused by the Tea Party. And I think the Tea Party tends to get vilified. But I think, as you saw over the weekend, registered Democrat was safely able to go through an entire weekend with 400 Tea Partiers and still come out on the other side, thinking that you had some hospitality, I hope, some Southern hospitality as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. I have to tell you, it's always delightful to get together with the folks in South Carolina. And look, Southern hospitality is world-renowned and justifiably so. The food was great. The people were wonderful. The venue at the hotel was wonderful as well. Joe Dugan and company, Ron Hughes and all the other folks out there, and Mike Patton, who the last time I was there drove me around. Poor guy had a stroke, and it was a gift to see him doing well. His wife was kind enough to drive him by. We got to visit with each other for a bit. I really feel that these are a bunch of friends at this point, not just people that I've associated with because of the immigration issue, but truly friends. And you know, this gets to a point that I want to make, and I made this point at the end of my presentation. I was given the privilege of addressing this group. I was on for about 20 minutes. And in fact, I just posted a link to the convention and to what I had to say and what the other speakers had to say. But, you know, the Tea Party gets a lot of abuse from a lot of people. Supposedly it's on its last legs. Well, as somebody once famously remarked, rumors of my demise are greatly exaggerated. I can assure you that rumors of the demise of the Tea Party are greatly exaggerated. But I'm not a Tea Party.
Yeah.
I'm still registered as a Democrat. You know, we have got to unite as Americans. And we may have our disagreements. And I don't care if it's about abortion. I don't care if it's about school prayer or gay marriage. There's a whole smorgasbord of issues out there. One size does not fit all. And the Founding Fathers and the First Amendment really made it clear that they understood that we can be a contentious bunch, Americans. You know, that's our birthright. Because, you know, most people, Lauren, when you ask about the First Amendment, they will immediately rattle off freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of religion. And then you say to them, it's like the second stanza of America the Beautiful, you know. You say, well, you're leaving two things out. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen that puzzled look. What is this guy talking about? What did I leave out? Well, you left out, if you don't talk about it, the right to seek redress of grievances. And boy, oh boy, as Terry Anderson, the late great radio talk show host, used to say, if you ain't mad, you ain't paying attention. We certainly have grievances. But finally, it's about the right for peaceable assemblage. And I believe that the Founding Fathers put that right into the Constitution, right at the top, right in the First Amendment, right up there with freedom of speech and press and religion, because they understood you cannot live in a true democracy without the ability to confront one another peacefully. Leave your guns, your knives, and your clubs at home, but have that discussion. Have the discourse. Because back then, when this country was founded, there was no radio, there was no television, there was no internet. If you wanted to communicate, it had to be face-to-face, person-to-person. And that's what
right.
They were
and
saying.
You know what? One of the things, though, too, and this may somehow link into what you're going to talk about tonight, is, you know, one of the things when you even say freedom and you just even say that first word, is that at least we were all speaking the same language. And when I say that, I don't mean that sarcastically at all, although I think English should be our, you know, the language of, you know, you have to have one language that everybody kind of speaks and it's the known language. But here's a little bit of the disconnect that I think that happens in some of the, what I'm going to just say is quote unquote potential debates. And now remember the word debate always meant healthy debate. And, I was actually going back over your 2007 article that you did where you made the analogy between the Challenger launch and some debates that were going on in the Senate at the time.
Right.
And I thought that was a great analogy, but let me just pull back into what I was going to say. Let's just take the word freedom, okay, which is right there in the First Amendment and is also throughout some of the other, you know, preamble and things like that. Mm-hmm. So freedom, what does that mean to you? And then you have to understand in other languages and in other doctrines or other, you know, jurisprudence, laws, that word takes on a totally different meaning than the understanding that you and I may have of the definition of freedom.
Right.
So that's where a real big disconnect comes in, I think, nowadays in our country, as we've watched, you know, the globalization of everything. And I think, you know, one of the things that you're going to be talking about is Fox Latino today. And so that really, that sort of came to my mind is, you know, here's one of the things that creates an inability to have healthy debate with people is when you're really not talking, you're not speaking the same language. So
well,
you just communicate over each other.
You're right. And you know, it's funny because one of the things I've done, you know, and by the way, for you folks out there, if you become aware of venues, places where perhaps I could come and visit and participate in panel discussions or debates anywhere in the country, have bags will travel. You know, I've been everywhere from Hawaii to Santa Barbara to Seattle to Arizona to Alabama, Indiana, you name it, I've probably been there. This has been an amazing journey, figuratively and literally. But I've been to Columbia University, to their Graduate School of Journalism. I also participated in a debate at the Columbia Law School. And it's a very liberal school. You know, we know it's a bastion of liberalism right here in New York in the Northeast. And there was a professor who invited me a number of times to address a graduate journalism school. And this young lady, very pleasant woman, very bright, but we had our issues, was a member of the Cuban flotilla that came here from Mariel, but she came here as an infant. And we, over time, she found out that we disagreed less than she thought she did. It was kind of interesting, the evolution. But in the beginning, she thought I was this evil guy, and she wanted to beat up on me, forgive the reference, like some pinata. And she was upset because I've always thought that we do need a national language, and I do consider myself a liberal. I'm registered as a Democrat. But, you know, to me, language is the mortar that holds a society together. We don't have to share the same religion. We don't have to practice any religion at all. I don't care. That's your freedom as an American. And we should cherish those freedoms and honor those freedoms and respect people who practice those freedoms.
We should let those people live, I think. We should let people who don't want to,
But here's my point. As long as your religious belief does not cause you to harm somebody else, have at it. But with all the diversity, and as a New Yorker, you know, I love the diversity of New York. I could live anywhere. I'm retired. But I love New York because of its diversity. But we need to have a common language. Otherwise, we can't communicate, we can't interact. And when you can't interact with other people, we become mistrustful. That's just human nature. And we've gone so wacky on this issue. About a year ago, Curtis Lewa from the Guardian Angels, who has a radio program here in New York City, and I've been on his show a bunch of times.
Oh, wow. I'll have to listen to that, too. I think the Guardian Angels that's a great group.
It is a great group, and they're all over the world now. But what was interesting was the Korean Businessmen's Association refused to put any English on their store signs. And the New York City Council said you can't do that. When there's an emergency, the first responders, whether it's the police, the fire department, EMS, nobody knows where to go. And, you know, this is endangering the safety and the well-being of your community. And this president of the Korean Businessmen's Association back then made a statement that absolutely infuriated everybody, myself included, because he said, when you're in our community, we want you to feel as though you're in Korea, not New York. And a journalist said to him, but don't you understand you're losing business? Because people who can't read the signs don't know what the stores are, you're losing the business of anybody who's not Korean-speaking. And his response, infuriatingly, was, I don't want them to be here.
Wow.
Building that kind of an enclave. We've gone from a melting pot, or at least a salad bowl, to balkanizing America.
And multicultural.
It goes beyond multicultural. What this really does is to create barriers among different people. And once you divide this up, we're no longer e pluribus unum, out of many one. And
dangerous. That's this wonderful Latin phrase that we were really founded on.
Yes.
It's the diversity that we unite on that makes us strong.
And so here you have this diversity becoming a wedge. And you look at the politicians, and you look at the folks with an agenda, and it's all about this concept of divide and conquer. So we have fellow Americans staring each other down and saying, oh, you're one of those crazy Tea Partiers. Oh, you're one of those liberal SOB Democrats. Ha ha. And I remember sitting at an event in Arizona, and I kind of got used to the rhetoric that gets overheated all too frequently. And some guys stood up and made some remark about, oh, those Democrats are baby killers. And I got up and I said, you know, that's the dopiest thing I've ever heard. And
anytime anybody uses an all generalization, that's usually not based in, you know, in a good statement. It's just overgeneralizing any particular group of people.
But it goes beyond
that's
that.
Really not really American, honestly.
No, but
I really wish we would have
punched
people
so
much.
But it's another problem that you should think about, Lauren, and that everyone out there, I hope, thinks about. If we're going to come to a consensus and work together, then we have to accept the fact that other people have different ideas and ideals. We need, in my judgment, and you may disagree, but we need to divorce immigration from all the other challenges, and there's a reason for it.
I agree. And looking back at some of your old articles, that, you know, that particularly one that was done in June of 2007, absolutely. This issue needs to be separated out and compartmentalized and dealt with head on with within the laws of our what our Constitution says and what you know, what's out there for our federal, you know, the titles that oversee the immigration statute.
Well, there's a reason too, and I'll tell you why, because immigration is not the singular issue that the open borders advocates, those who oppose secure borders, the people I've come to call the immigration anarchists, will say, oh, it's just a fringe issue. Baloney.
Mm.
Not because it's the issue I'm well-versed in because of my career and so forth, but reality is this. Immigration is not a single issue. It's a singular issue because it impacts the war on terror. It impacts our efforts to eradicate drug trafficking and transnational crime. It's about jobs. It's about the economy. It's about education and health care and public health and the unemployment rates. You can't name a significant challenge or threat confronting America or Americans that's not being hammered, because for decades, and it's both parties, folks, you know, if you know a politician who is right there with his party and puts the party above all else, then you're looking at a politician who's not representing his constituents.
Exactly. And, I mean, our founding fathers even recognized all of those issues, too, is that, you know, you have to put aside some of the differences to get to what's good for the society.
Prioritize.
And they set up a wonderful checks and balances system that is, unfortunately, you know, not even really being practiced today. I think
you're
that's
leading,
why
you're
really
leading me right into the article that I sent you, in fact. Great, great segue, isn't it? But, you know, I wrote a commentary, and that's why I would ask all you folks out there to please go to those websites, you know, but in particular.
Fabulous. Tons of information. Really good.
Well, I'm trying to make it fact-based, not, you know, some people shoot their mouths off and they come up with all kinds of wacky ideas. If I write something, I try to ground it in facts and or experience. And I wrote an article, and it kind of gave me, and I know it gave some of my friends a chuckle, but I called it Obama on Immigration Laws. We don't need no stinking laws. And, of course, I was modeling that after the famous line from the film The Golden Sierra Madre with Humphrey Bogart, where Bogey confronts some federales and says, where are your badges? And the guy says, badges? We don't need no stinking badges. Point of fact, there is supposed to be checks and balances. There's supposed to be separation of power. And when you think about the president, he runs the executive branch. And we all think about executives, the executive suite, and people have forgotten what the word executive comes from.
Right. Again, back to language. What
it
language means, are we speaking?
Right. Mm-hmm. And it means execute, make happen. He is not only the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, but the president is the commander-in-chief of our law enforcement agents who work for the federal government. When I was at the INS, I was part of the Justice Department, but again, the attorney general is under the president of the United States. So when you have the president saying, oh, well, Congress didn't act. You know, he did this whole thing with the DREAM Act, and he called it prosecutorial discretion. I called it prosecutorial deception for an article that I wrote for Fox News Latino. Because he said Congress didn't act. Well, guess what, folks? Voting no is acting. It wasn't the way he wanted them to act, but is a nay vote not acting, Lauren?
No, it's sending a word. And just like you said in your article in 2007, the sums up for a launch is very rare. And that's the way the bills even becoming laws used to be very rare. There used to be so many debates and the conditions weren't quite right, or there was something in the bill that just didn't, you know, was a disconnect from what the mission was trying to accomplish. And in all of those situations, bills were turned down and voted no. And you probably would see that over history much more frequently than now. What we're seeing is things just getting pushed faster and faster. And really that's because both houses in our legislature have gotten the ability to, you know, have some stock options that they can leverage to their votes. And that's why we send these congresspeople and senators up to Washington, and they may be, you know, the average American, you know, middle class person, and they end up, you know, millionaires and billionaires, because what ends up happening is we're just, you know, allowing a forum in government that shouldn't be there. And we're inoculating them differently than the regular American public. And that's simply not an American way of doing business. And
well, it isn't, but look, money corrupts, okay? And if you look at campaign finance, I was a federal agent for 30 years. I was not allowed to accept a cup of coffee. If I came to your house, Lauren, in my official capacity as an agent, because let's say your next-door neighbor
was
somebody.
Man, that would have been scary. I'm glad that didn't happen. Just kidding.
Well, I wasn't that evil, you know.
I know. But, you're tough, though.
But typically you'd go knock on a door and say, you know, we're interested in the guy living down the block. Do you see anything going on? And people would almost always invite you in. And typically they'd say, well, you know, Agent Cutler, we're having dinner right now. Why don't you join us for a cup of coffee? What was expected of us, and I can tell you what we always did, was I would say, thank you so much for the hospitality. A glass of ice water would be perfect. And the reason we did that was to make the public out there understand that we were going to hold them at arm's length, that this was
right.
not going to be
yeah.
a private relationship where now I'm your buddy, okay?
Exactly.
Now
yeah.
you have politicians taking money. We're not talking about a cup of coffee or a hot dog. We're talking about substantial amounts of money. When someone writes those checks, don't you think there is an expectation of a return? Because to them, that's an investment. And think about this. And I have a friend who's also a lawyer who disagrees with me on this and says, well, under the First Amendment, you can give money to anybody you want. But you know what disturbs me, Lauren? And I'd love to know what your opinion is. What do you make of somebody who gives equal amounts of money to two candidates running for the same office? Are you then supporting a political politician, platform, position, party, or are you simply trying to hedge your bet to make sure that when the election is over, you win? To me, it would seem to be almost like a violation of the antitrust laws or something. And I understand the First Amendment component, but doesn't it seem pretty smelly? I mean, does that really pass the stink test?
Oh, no, it doesn't. And I mean, it demonstrates people who are weak at best and don't put what the values are first, because you can't, you can't have a good thought and a bad thought in your mind at the same time, you know?
Well, but I think they want to make sure that they will have access to that politician, whoever it is that sits behind the desk.
Right. So apparently the good thought in that particular person's mind is, what is this going to do for me?
For me.
Not, is
That's
this
right.
going to follow the law? Am I doing an ethical thing? And here's what's really interesting, too, you know, with John Kerry's, you know, potential hearing coming up to see if he's fit to be our, you know, new Secretary of State. Speaking of talking about things that you make money in Congress, you know, John and Teresa Hines Kerry, they traded shares with like ResMed and a few other of the medical different, you know, stocks and stuff. As the Obamacare bill was going through and it was getting negotiated and things, and of course they obviously have plenty of money, and everybody down, you know, used that against Mitt Romney for having money, but John Kerry has an extreme amount of wealth between himself and his wife, and you know, here they are in Congress trading out stuff within the pharmaceutical industry, knowing that lobbyists are coming in and what bills are going to pass and what it's going to become a law. And they're literally making money off of the backs of the taxpayers and creating laws that are unconstitutional and un-American. And this, to me, is corruption at the ultimate. And so I say this to you just because I'm interested to hear what you have to say about, you know, John Kerry coming up for his to see, you know, these are the kind of things that when you look into the past history of the way people act, you know, it causes you to raise an eyebrow as to the fitness of their ability
Here's what worries me. I'll tell you what worries me. You know, if you engage in insider trading, you go to jail. My first wife, may she rest in peace, was an executive at the stock exchange. So every year we had to, or she had to, because I didn't work for the exchange, I was a federal agent, but she had to submit a full report to the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, about any stocks that we may have bought and that sort of thing, so they could make certain that there was no insider trading. First of all, Congress was exempt the insider trading provisions. Now think about that. It gets worse. It gets worse, but I'll tell you where it gets worse in a moment when you stop and give this thought. But they're sitting at a hearing, and they're hearing about certain things, or they're reading reports about activities that certain corporations are involved in. So that gives them really a leg up on everybody in the stock market. But here's what really worries me. Imagine if you had significant holdings in, I don't know, the telecom industry, the airline industry, whatever.
Sure.
You could vote for legislation that would materially affect the profitability of the stocks that you held.
That's what they've been doing.
It's incredible capital cronyism. It's not only having the knowledge, which is bad enough, and which would be a felony for average folk like you and me, but they have the capacity to alter taxes, alter the way we do business, alter treaties. And if you look at what happens with all these folks, that goes to George Bush Sr. as well.
Yeah,
these
you're right
about
that.
These former ambassadors, he was an ambassador to China, and they become enamored with the countries where they serve. How many people who serve as ambassadors to China or other countries, once they are in elected office, suddenly do things that provide advantages to the governments of the countries where they served as ambassador? Doesn't it almost seem incestuous?
Oh, it's definitely... It's definitely them taking care of their own and what their agenda is, which never was anticipated. Well, it was anticipated, but there were mechanisms within, you know, the setup of our American government to try to protect us from this. And I think what's ended up happening is that, you know, we got comfortable in general, and I'm guilty of this as well, is, you know, we presumed that the people who were in leadership were doing the right thing, or that there was enough of a checks and balances that the justice scale would even out at the end of the day. And that presumption was at our own peril, I think.
Yep.
You know, I think it's absolutely important for individual people to become educated, because one of the things that our founding fathers did say, I think it was James Madison, is that, you know, this system of government is only going to work if you have a well-educated population.
Sorry.
And you know, then the question becomes now, you know, who owns the message and who's educating our youth? And I think that's a serious question that every person needs to look into. You know, are we stressed out parents that rely on the public schools and daycare and this kind of thing? Or are we taking the extra time that we need to make sure that our children know that they're loved and what our system of government is?
Let's go step beyond that. Who's educating the American people? Look at journalism. You know,
journalism is frightening, really.
No, wait, let me finish the thought. When you see upheaval, when you see coup d'etat, where governments are overthrown, what's the first thing the rebel sees? The radio stations, right? Because it's the ability to communicate. It's the ability to keep the public informed. You look at totalitarian governments and you see massive propaganda machines, correct?
Going back to what we originally started about, it's the ability to communicate and use language that we all understand.
But also,
and so,
yes, and by the way, that's where there's a problem, because if you keep people from learning the mainstream language of a society, it's easy to keep them in the dark and to use the term we did back in government, to give them the mushroom treatment. You know what the mushroom treatment is? You keep them in the dark and you feed them a lot of fertilizer.
That's what's going on. I'm not even kidding. I didn't realize this, but this is a new piece of information that came to me today, and it's obviously been out there, but I wasn't aware of it. Was that you know, it was in 2005 that Prince Alwaleed, and I say that incorrectly, I'm sure. You say it for me. Alwaleed.
Halloween sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah. He bought 5.5% of News Corp.
Right.
Which
the parent
that basically
of Fox
is
News.
Like Fox News, you know, and that was back in 2005. And apparently at that point, he was able to make like one phone call to the owner of the time or the owner and the operator, which was Rupert Murdaugh. And with his one phone call, he was able to change the wording from Muslim riots in France to just civil riots. And this is very similar to the
where did that information come from, by the way?
I got that information from Diana West, who just wrote an article Friday, January 11th in a syndicated column that came out on basically discussing Al Gore's, you know, contract with the current current TV to Al Jazeera, which is the Qatar family, and basically what kind of impact that has, because now you're going from television stations that are airing the message that, you know, whatever the message is being spoken in a language that we understand, to now we're having, I believe it is propaganda, if you want to use that word, but coming in a language, even if it's translated into English, means something different. You know, for example, the word, and this is a channel, it's Al Rizala.
You got me there.
That's a TV station, too, and it translates into the Islamic message. That's what it actually means. But people aren't going to know that when they're, you know, watching the TV. And these are the people who literally own these media forums now.
Let's back up a bit. I am sure there's a lot of influence. I want to be clear that you're talking about something that someone's claiming. I don't know if this is accurate, but what concerns me is this, okay?
Okay.
I don't know that we are getting the news objectively when there is an agenda. See, everyone wants to blame the liberal media. And here we go again. We're going to divide America, liberal, conservative. I think what we're dealing with is a corporate media. What they were supposed to do within the news industry, you know, one of the groups I work with is Alan L. Freed Associates. Sid Davis is the moderator very often when I do these seminars for the government agencies, whether it's military or federal federal law enforcement or federal intelligence services. And Sid was a vice president, I believe it was at NBC News, if he's listening. Sid, I hope I'm getting this right. But he's a gentleman who has been retired for quite some time, and he made the point one day when we were chatting that if he tried to put news on such as that which we are seeing now at 7 o'clock or 6 o'clock or whenever the news comes on where you folks live, if he was the producer of this stuff, he would have lost his job in less than a week. The wall that was supposed to separate corporate profits from the news I don't think exists, and I'm sure he doesn't think exists any longer. And what we're really looking at now is a corporate push for profitability. And in fact, there's an organization, you can go online, that's verifiable, and I like to be careful about what I say because I want to be able to point people to websites where we can verify what I'm saying. The Chamber of Commerce has gotten together with the hotel, hospitality, and travel industries. Now they've added to this witch's brew the manufacturing associations, and they've created something known as the Discover America Partnership. And what this is about is making it ever easier for foreign visitors to come to the United States and presumably spend their money. This is like the Barker at the carnival on the Midway. If you could remember those characters, think of the Music Man, you know, the guy with the straw hat and the sleeve garters and the striped shirts and the megaphone. Step this way, folks. Step right up, you know, because the whole idea was to get them under the tent so they could convince them to buy that extra thing of cotton candy or, in New York, it wouldn't be more than a 16-ounce cup of soda. God help us all. But the idea was to bring in as many people so you could grab them by the ankles and shake them until their pockets were empty. So they have forgotten that Al-Qaeda has already discovered America. They have forgotten that Hezbollah and Iran and the Quds shock troops stationed in Latin America have all discovered America. They forgot that the Mexican cartels have discovered America. There's a long list of unsavory players who have discovered America would love nothing better than to attack us, kill us, commit crimes within our borders. And this isn't about vilifying immigrants. This isn't about vilifying tourists. This is, again, I go back to what I think I said at the beginning of this program, and if not, I know I've said it frequently. The difference between an immigrant and an illegal alien is comparable to the difference between a house guest and a burglar. I want to make certain that when I let someone into my home, that we look through the peephole first and then admit the person, not let them in and figure out how do we fight this guy off, because now that he's in my house, I find out that he has a gun under his jacket. You know, so that's the situation that immigration is in, but you've got a conflict because the Chamber of Commerce and all these industries that make tremendous campaign contributions to the politicians on both sides of the aisle and buy airtime for commercials. And look, ABC News and Disney, is that not part of the travel and hospitality industry?
Sure. And actually, the Saudi prince that I just referred to that bought the News Corp owns stock in Disney. I mean, what's crazy is that
it's a limited amount of people now
that are at the top. Owning the message.
It's a perfect storm. I hate using the term perfect storm, having survived Sandy here in New York City. But everything has come together and not in our favor. you know, it's like when I went down to my basement, I was reminded of Richard Dreyfuss in Jaws when he said, we need a bigger boat. That was how I felt during that storm. Well,
yeah,
I mean, think of what this is doing to America. We're hearing about how, on the one hand, we've created 180,000 new jobs. Of course, what they're not talking about is these are probably $8 or $9 an hour jobs. Lots of luck trying to live on that salary. But we're bringing in about 150,000 legal foreign workers each and every month. And that does not include the illegal aliens who run the border. So we are inundated by cheap labor. The way that America built the middle class, folks, was to have immigration laws enforced, guess what, by the Labor Department prior to the Second World War. That was how we built the middle class, to make certain that American workers would not have to compete with foreign workers. Now we're being told, in fact, ABC did a story overnight, it was almost the end of my night's sleep, we've got to have more people with the DREAM Act, we need the young people, because the population in California is getting old and decrepit, and they're going on Medicare and Medicaid, and they're falling apart, and who's going to keep them afloat? Well, wait a moment. Illegal aliens are draining the economy. Foreign workers in general are sending tens of billions of dollars in remittances out of the country, which means that the money remitters, whether it's Western Union, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, you name the flavor, they are the silent partner to anybody who opens a bank account to be able to move money out of the United States. We're looking at the immigration lawyers and the corporations that want cheap labor. But back then, during the Second World War, the Greatest Generation, our leaders stood for the American citizen, the American worker, and they said, no, we're going to protect you from unfair foreign competition. That's not happening today. What's the consequence? Hourly wages, for the first time in I don't know how long, are actually declining. The size of the middle class is contracting. We're being told the DREAM Act, and you know what's so remarkable? And, you know, we were talking about words, and you're an attorney, and words are critical. Words are tools to a lawyer, yes? The word alien is actually a legal term.
Yes, absolutely. Words are very important.
Very important. They're important to journalists. They're important to lawyers. They're important to all of us. The word alien, my gosh, you use that word and people will want to hold a public lynching. I've written for Fox News Latino, and most recently they said, oh, you can't use that term, Mr. Cutler. You can't use alien. We'll call them undocumented workers. Well, that's not what the issue is.
That's what that prince did to try to change the language from Muslim riots, which is exactly what they were in France, to civil riots. Or, for example, the FBI has had to change their language in describing the Fort Hood, you know, massacre. That was terrorism. That was not workplace violence. But, you know, people can't say, hey, the guy was a soldier of Allah.
But here's the problem. The word alien simply means any person who is not a citizen or national of the United States. That's all it means. Now, there's no insult there, but there is clarity there. So the other side is doing everything they can to create false impressions, false allegations, because they know that the laws and common sense and morality and the facts all conspire against them. So what are they left with? We're going to use artful language. So it's remarkable because I've done debates with the ACLU and all the other usual suspects, if you will, and I have come to say that, you know, the term undocumented, which goes back to Jimmy Carter, really means that that person is dangerous. Undocumented means that they will not or cannot show you official identity documents to verify who they are. And in this era of terrorists and so forth, that should keep us awake. So they,
yeah, imagine if I showed up undocumented somewhere.
That's right, but now
you
what
know,
are they doing?
I wouldn't go
they're
anywhere.
They're using the word unauthorized. And you see, those of us on the right side of this debate, and it's not the right side because it's the side that I'm on, but if you look at why we have the immigration laws in the first place, it's about protecting innocent lives and the jobs of American workers and to protect them and their families. Illegal alien is a constant, and it's accurate, it's descriptive, and it's right to the point. The other side is using deceptive language and creating illusions that don't hold up to the scrutiny of the bright light. So when we're being told, well, it's the liberal media, no, it's the corporate media that's doing most of this damage because this is about profit motive. This is about driving profit.
You hit it. You hit the nail on the head. And really, by them saying the liberal media, it's just another tool to cause the dissension and division and chaos. But what people really, and this is why it's just so important to anyone who's listening to the show and, you know, for us to continue in what we do, is just to make sure that people are educated as to, you know, what does freedom mean to be an American and what does freedom mean in other places that might be trying to come over here and change our definition of freedom. And then the question becomes, well, why should we, you know, why not let that happen? Or maybe why should we try to not let that happen? You know, I mean, we have to start engaging our own selves at the very most local level in education and then healthy debate, which, you know, isn't political correctness. It's really not necessarily. It's that you can speak what's on your mind, have an opinion, and even if it differs from somebody else, try to find out, you know, why you have that opinion, what's it based in, and, you know, where do you go from there? And is what you stand for, if you can define what you stand for, is it worth trying to defend, or do you just, you know, succumb to maybe something else that's going on in society that is trying to change it, you know? I mean, that's what the real question becomes is, you know, what is our particular individual purpose in this big, you know, this big sort of life that we're living right now?
Well, you're right, but look at the dangers that we are exposing ourselves and our kids to. And by the way, folks, this isn't about xenophobia, and it's not about brown skin.
No.
You know, we have to be so careful and clear about this, because this tends to be what the other side likes to make the accusations about. Let me give you an example.
I love people. I love people in general. I mean, what I usually, you know, have a problem with or have concerns about would be doctrine that doesn't mesh with what
Let me give you an example
of
doctrine that doesn't mesh. Let me give you an example. I love to go to the websites by the Justice Department and ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. If you remember when I spoke at the Tea Party convention last weekend, I said that it was dumpster diving. Because you're sorting through the trash to figure out what they're really saying. On January 4th of this year, the Justice Department ran an interesting story. Foreign national pleads guilty in Houston to human smuggling charges. And they start out by saying a foreign national pleaded guilty today to federal human smuggling charges for his role in a scheme to smuggle undocumented migrants. Now, let's stop and look at these words. A migrant to me, and you tell me if you disagree with me on this, Lauren, a migrant conjures up the image of a farm worker, true or false?
True. And I think you made a reference to birds, too. And I thought, like, you know, sometimes migration, you think about like, birds.
Well, I was talking about the migration
policy.
No, but I'm talking about this particular article. Yeah, I was talking about Doris Meisner, who had been the commissioner and who was the force behind the amnesty of 86, which ended so disastrously for America. Her organization is the Migration Policy Institute. And that's right, I did say that it reminded me of the swallows returning to Capistrano. They're migrating.
I know. Even that, you know, title is so offensive, and yet, you know, they
well,
seem
but,
to
here's
be
my, but here's
the
my
most
point.
Taller people.
I'm mm-hmm. going somewhere with this. Bear with me.
All right.
What they talked about here was his role in smuggling undocumented migrants. And if you remember, Chavez, Cesar Chavez, was the president of the American Farm Workers Union, the migrant workers. He was adamantly opposed, by the way, to illegal immigration. He actually called for violence in some of the documents that I've seen. Today, of course, the open borders folks, the immigration anarchists, are trying to change history and saying, oh, he was all about, you know, the Latino population. He was all about American farm workers. But the term migrant worker almost always, almost invariably conjures up images of the people on the farms doing the tough stoop labor, picking the cabbage, picking the lettuce, picking the other vegetables, and so forth. Migrants. Now, these migrants, however, were from India. Now, this is what disturbs me. The guy that they're talking about, this foreign national, was a man by the name of Fabiano Augusto Amorim, 28 years of age and a citizen of Brazil. Now, let's slow down and give this a little bit of thought and realize that further on in the news release, it said, and I'll take the sentence and read it to you, in support of the conspiracy, Amorim and other conspirators recruited individuals in India who were willing to pay up to, are you ready for this figure? $60,000, $60,000 to be smuggled into the United States. What farm worker is going to pay $60,000 to be smuggled into the United States to do farm work? Let's go a step further. And I don't know that this guy was involved with terrorism. This is conjecture. We're flying blindly because we're not given all the facts for a number of reasons, but this was the thought that came to me. The tri-border region of Brazil, which was well documented, by the way, in that report, A Line in the Sand, that was issued by Congressman Mike McCall, who, by the way, as of right now, chairs the Homeland Security Committee in the House of Representatives. And he talked about this issue that I've been hammering for years about the terror training camps in the tri-border region of Brazil, where Brazil abuts with Argentina and Paraguay. We know that we're talking about...
Man, it's unbelievable.
Yes.
I'm going to have to... you can finish, but I'm going to have to run. I've got... you know my little situation here.
Yes,
so
that's fine.
I have to run and go take care of some other things that are going on.
Laura.
But it is always an honor and a privilege to be on your radio show.
And great having you.
So informative. So please finish the line of, you know, the line of thought that you were finishing there.
Okay.
And I apologize for having to kick off a little early, but I've got to go take care of something.
No, not a problem. And thank you for joining me, and I look forward to speaking with you soon. But here is the point that I'm making. We have somebody from Brazil, maybe not involved with terrorism. Again, I worry about that part of the world. And that's not to besmirch Brazilians. There are many wonderful people from Brazil who come here. But we're talking about a smuggler circumventing the immigration laws, bringing in people from India. And there are many non-Muslims who are living in India. And many Muslims are not terrorists either. The majority of Muslims, thank God, don't subscribe to radical Islam. We're just talking about a small percentage. But think of what just 19 terrorists did to us on 9/11. So we have this guy from Brazil bringing in people from India, $60,000 a person. And when they talk about the way they brought them here, it was amazing. They were being smuggled in from Peru via the maritime route from the Bahamas into southern Florida. They were taking them every which way, getting them from Latin America into the United States. When you see that kind of circuitous route, that level of sophistication, that kind of money being spent, you have to worry about the national security implications of that particular operation. And what was disconcerting to me, there was nothing in the news release about efforts being made to locate the aliens that he smuggled into the United States. So that obviously begs the question, where are they now, and do they pose a threat to America's security? You follow my point, Lauren? I guess Lauren is gone. Then there's another story that I want you folks to be aware of. And I wrote a commentary, and this will be up, I presume, shortly on the CAPS website. And the title for this was ICE Deports an Iranian National Convicted of Smuggling Technology to Iran. And what did this guy smuggle? He was smuggling high-tech, very costly pumps. And this was over a period of 2 years at least, according to an ICE news release. He was sentenced to just 41 months in prison. I'm going to tell you what's disturbing about this story. Those pumps, folks, apparently could be used to enrich uranium, to create uranium fuel. I'm not certain if it could be used to upgrade uranium fuel into weapons-grade uranium. But again, when you're talking about refining uranium, you're talking about the potential to assist a country that is our adversary. And then what happens? So where in the world does this take us? And this guy gets 41 months in jail, serves less than half of that time, and then was deported back to Iran. When the Rosenbergs spied on the United States and were found guilty of it, they were executed. They were alleged to have spied and given nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union in the, I believe it was 1953. And those activities cost them their lives. Here we have somebody, along with a couple of his buddies from Iran, a country that is all but at war with us at this point, moving high-tech equipment that may well have serious ramifications for America's national security. You know, we hear so much about efforts to block the proliferation of nuclear weapons, and this guy is here from Iran, and you have to ask the question, how were they able to enter the United States? How were they able to start a company through which they move that high-tech equipment? And what in the world were we doing to try to ferret out more of these characters? You see, what we really need to talk about, ladies and gentlemen, is how, in real-world terms, these failures at border security, these failures to enforce the immigration laws, not only deprive Americans of job opportunities, and boy, oh boy, to people losing their homes to foreclosure, this is deadly serious business. On a personal level, how much more serious can it be than the threat of losing your house to foreclosure, winding up homeless, being unable to properly care for your kids? According to some of the news reports I've seen, one in four American children, one in six Americans, period, are now living below the poverty line in these United States of America. So this is not inconsequential, but add to the mix the stories that I've just given you that were taken directly from government websites. This wasn't in the Daily Inquirer. This is right there on the website. Go to ICE, go to DOJ, and you see these stories. And that's what I've been trying to do, to look at those stories, because, you know, this is where they're trying to tell everybody what a great job they're doing. But when you read between the lines, they're not doing a great job. You know, I love using analogies. And I know that some of you may get a chuckle over this. I hope it gives you a little bit of levity, but there's a lesson to it. It's a story about little Jimmy, who every day comes home and someone beat the hell out of him, and his father is getting more and more frustrated with him because poor old Jimmy just doesn't seem to have the gumption to stand up for himself. And his father takes him aside finally, and he's just so upset, and he says, Jimmy, if you don't start standing up for yourself and if you don't punch back when these kids take you on, I'm going to spank you. And poor Jimmy is kind of upset, and this is obviously an old joke because today God only knows what the school officials would say if they heard the story. And poor Jimmy goes to school the next day and comes home, and sure enough, he's got another black eye. And his father goes nuts and says, didn't I tell you you got to stand up for yourself? Didn't I tell you to fight back? And Jimmy looks at the father without blinking an eye, at least his good eye. He said, Pop, you should be proud of me. I hit that guy right on the fist with my eye. And that, folks, is all too often the way that ICE is doing its job. They put a story out there saying, didn't we do a great job? We arrested 26 gang members. And then you read a report, and there was such a report just a couple of weeks ago, that said, you know something? There are 800,000 illegal aliens wandering around the towns and cities across this vast nation, who have been before immigration judges, who have been ordered deported. Many of them have criminal histories, been convicted for assault and robbery and child abuse and weapons possession, one guy at least for murder, narcotics trafficking. And for whatever reason, we never remove them from our midst, but they're out there among us. 800,000. And some of them are on welfare. Some of them have jobs at airports where God knows what threat that poses to security. But what are we being told? Oh, yes, ICE went out and rounded up 26 of the people, and most of them had been in custody previously. It's like stocking a fishing pond and then saying, look, I caught fish. Yes, but you put the fish into that pond just last week. This is the lunacy, folks, that is passing for immigration law enforcement. And any time immigration does anything, all those immigration anarchists jump up and start screaming, oh my God, look at how they're cracking down on illegal immigration. Let me tell you a little story. The New York City Police Department, to put things in perspective, has approximately 35,000 police officers right now, down from the high of 40,000. Budgetary constraints and that sort of thing caused police officers who retired or left the job to not be replaced, so we have a problem with attrition. And all the politicians are wringing their hands and saying, oh my gosh, what do we do? What do we do? 35,000 cops. We don't have enough police. Where immigration law enforcement is concerned, there are roughly 7,000 ICE agents for the entire United States of America. And ICE does not only enforce immigration laws, they enforce customs law. They go after the child predators. Look, these are laws that need to be enforced. But we probably have no more than about 2,000 to 3,000 ICE agents enforcing immigration law. 2,000 to 3,000. Compare that to 35,000 police officers just for the city of New York. We probably have fewer than 10% the number of ICE agents as there are police officers for the state of New York enforcing immigration laws at ICE. That's an absurdity. We're told there are about 12 million illegal aliens. Even if that number is accurate, that number is significantly higher than the number of people who live and work in New York City. And yet we have so few people enforcing those laws. And we're being told, oh my God, look at what they're doing. They're deporting all these people. They aren't. We're giving employment authorization to people without knowing who they are. The so-called dreamers that we keep hearing about, let me tell you what, folks, they're not even doing face-to-face interviews. We know that the terrorists who attacked our country on 9/11 in the aggregate used more than 3,000 identities. I'm sorry, 300 identities, not 3,000 identities. After a while, you lose track of the numbers. They used more than 300 identities, 19 people. I was reviewing the 9/11 Commission report. Ramzi Youssef, back in 1992, entered the United States using false documents. One of his accomplices, a guy by the name of Ajaj, was arrested for using false documents, but Ramzi Youssef uttered the two magic words that got him off the hook. And it wasn't abracadabra, it was political asylum. We granted him political asylum. And the result of him being granted political asylum meant that he was inside the United States and able to be one of the masterminds of the first attack at the World Trade Center. He had set that bomb off, and then he did what a lot of transnational criminals and international terrorists are able to do. He escaped through the trap door by leaving the United States. He headed out. Our folks, of course, tracked him down, brought him back here, put him on trial, and he famously remarked that he, you know, was sorry the towers were still standing. He actually told people that when they set off the bomb, his goal was to kill, 250,000 people. That was what his dream was, to murder 250,000 people. Can you imagine? Now, I want to know what kind of investigation our folks did where political asylum was concerned. And, you know, the month before that first attack at the World Trade Center, another guy by the name of Amil Kansi, a Pakistani national, shot up the CIA, killed two CIA officers, and wounded three others. And by the way, he also lied on an application for political asylum. So you would think that by now we figured it out. I mean, this stuff happened 20 years ago. 20 years ago, we had these two terrorist attacks committed by people who claimed political asylum and lied. Well, do you know what? The applications for political asylum still have very little integrity. It is rare that these folks are caught or that the investigations are done properly. There was another guy by the name of Fez Hazion, and those of you who have read my articles, whether it's at capsweb.org or michaelcutler.net, or if you've seen me talk about it on my video program at talkborder.com, you know that Fez Hazion was from Eritrea, and he was prosecuted for smuggling aliens from Africa into the United States through Guatemala. But what was so remarkable, again, going to the ICE website, dumpster diving, if you will, folks, they boasted about how this guy, who was in his early 20s, got arrested and pleaded guilty, if I remember correctly, to alien smuggling from Africa. Again, we know that there's a potential problem with terrorism in Africa. Think what's going on in Mali right now, where France has stepped in, and they're putting troops on the ground, and we're helping them with air support and transportation. But they're moving these folks into the United States. Maybe, maybe not, they're involved with terrorism. But this guy obviously lied on his application for political asylum. How do we know? Because they made that point in the ICE news release. They said that Fez Hazion, at the time that he claimed was running from law enforcement or whomever that was tormenting him in Eritrea, in reality was in Guatemala. So he got a slap on the wrist. Most likely they will not look for the people he smuggled in. What's remarkable, there wasn't a single word about anything being done to prosecute him for lying on his application for political asylum. That's a problem, because when he gets out of jail, the odds are that he will still enjoy status as a political refugee, even though he lied. He should have been prosecuted for making false statements on the application, because if he had been convicted of that crime, it would have been a simple matter to strip him of his refugee status so he could be deported. Odds are this guy will be released from prison and will be free to wander the streets of any town in the United States that he wants to go to. This does not help America one bit. Those immigration laws, I keep coming back to the fundamental basic reason for them, is to protect innocent lives and to protect the jobs of hardworking Americans who are finding it increasingly impossible to support their own families. And now we are seeing this massive push for amnesty. All I have to say is this. It is not xenophobic to want to see immigration laws enforced. It is not unfair to want the immigration laws enforced. What is unfair is to not enforce those laws, to make a mockery of the laws that provided opportunities for millions upon millions of legal immigrants, just like my mother, just like my dad's parents, just like my first wife's family, who came here legally and got their thin slice of the American dream, a dream that is becoming ever more elusive for the average American. And when I was talking to Lauren, the point that I was trying to make is that if you look at the term Dream Act, the A in Dream Act is the word alien. So if I go on a television program or a radio show and I use the word alien, oh my gosh, people faint. They fall down on the ground and they keel over. Oh my God, he said alien. But because they wanted to get the Dream Act out there, this image about the opportunities of America, well, where the Dream Act is concerned, suddenly the word alien became acceptable. Acceptable because there is an agenda in play, but what everyone seems to be forgetting is that it would now seem that in this day and age, where the American dream is concerned, Americans and lawful immigrants need not apply. That's crazy. No family would give money to charity when their own children go to bed hungry at night. That's irresponsible. And here, this is more than being about charity. It's about national security. It's about the threat to community safety. It's the damage being done because we lack the resolve, the ability, the spine, the integrity, the decency to enforce immigration laws that are so important. I want you to give this a bit of thought. Dennis Lynch asked if I would participate in his follow-on movie to They Come to America. He's doing a sequel, and this will focus on terrorism. And I was in Manhattan with him earlier this week. And during the course of the interview, I said something to him that seemed to catch his ear and the ear of his cameraman. I said to him, or to them, and it's on tape, and I hope it's in the documentary when it comes out. I hope it is. He said it will be. But I said that it's the job of our military to secure America's borders from outside the United States. And it's the job of DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, to enforce our borders from inside the United States. If DHS fails at its mission, and believe me, the evidence is abundant that they have failed and they continue to fail, but by failing in their vital mission, which is why I call them the Department of Homeland Surrender, they are negating the hard work, the dedication, the gallantry, and the incredible sacrifices of American men and women in uniform who are part of the armed services, who have gone in harm's way, and some of them not returned. Some have come home terribly injured, physically, emotionally, or both, to secure America's borders from outside the country, and it's being undermined by the failures of DHS to live up to its obligations to secure those borders from inside the United States and create an immigration system that has real integrity. You know, if you're sitting in a boat and it's got a bunch of holes in the floor, you could patch all the holes but for one, and ultimately that one hole in the bottom of the boat will cause that boat to wind up at the bottom of the lake. When you look at immigration, the bottom of that boat looks like Swiss cheese, folks. And that's got to change. And that's the responsibility that we the people have. You know, we are coming to the end of the program today, and you know I always like to end my commentaries by reminding people that democracy is not a spectator sport. When we go to restaurants, we are very specific about the food that we want to eat, the way that we want it prepared. If we don't like the way the dish comes out of the kitchen, we send it back, and if that doesn't work, we leave. We have got to be no less specific when dealing with those people who purport to be representing us. That is their job, to represent us, to look out for the well-being of the greatest number of Americans. Not American corporations, but American citizens. This is, after all, a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. You'd be hard-pressed to convince me or anybody with a half a brain that indeed this is still a government by the people. Not by the actions of this administration. And let's be fair, it's not just this administration. This has been a long time coming. But this administration has really stepped up that plunge. And we have to do something to stop it. And the best solution, folks, is to reach out to your elected representatives and make it clear to them that you are not as dumb as they hoped we are. That's your mission, your homework assignment, if you will. Please do everything in your power to get the politicians to listen to your voice, whether it's writing letters, making phone calls, or even, hopefully, sitting down with your elected representatives or at least with key people who work for them so they come to understand what it is we expect. That is how a democracy is supposed to work. Again, I want to thank all of you for joining me this Friday evening. It's always good to end the week sitting down and having these discussions with you. I hope you enjoy them as much as I enjoy being on this end of the line, so to speak. Again, the three websites that I would very much like for you to go visit, michaelcutler.net, talkborder.com, and, of course, visit that website for my friends out in Santa Barbara, California, at capsweb.org. Look forward to seeing you guys next week. Have a good weekend, everybody. So long for now.